Since its release in 1965, the impact of Dune has been long and far-reaching on popular culture, inspiring science fiction of all kinds, including direct adaptations for film and television, and perhaps a non-zero amount of inspiration for the first Star Wars film as well. But one of its biggest impacts has been in the development of the Warhammer 40,000 universe. So with the release of Denis Villeneuve's Dune Part 2 in cinemas on March 1st, 2024, I'd like to return to a series on the podcast we call Appendix W, and look at Frank Herbert's original novel Dune from 1965 in this episode of the Implausipod. Welcome to the Implausipod, a podcast about the intersection of art, technology, and popular culture. I'm your host, Dr. Implausible. So when we first started talking about Appendix W in the early days of the podcast back in September 22, I had posted that based on a list I had put up on the blog the year prior about what some of the foundational titles for the Warhammer 40,000 universe is. Now, Warhammer 40,000 is the grimdark gothic sci-fi series published by Games Workshop. The Warhammer 40,000 universe was originally introduced in 1987 with the version they called Rogue Trader, which has become affectionately known as the Blue Book. And I think I still have my rather well-used and worn copy that I picked up in the summer of 1988 on a band trip. For the most part, Warhammer 40,000 is a miniatures war game, though the Rogue Trader version had a lot more in common with Dungeons & Dragons, and there were some roleplay elements in there. The intellectual property now appears in everything from video games to action figures to merchandise of all sorts, to web shorts, and a massive amount of fiction set in that universe. As primarily a miniatures war game, it sits as a niche of a niche with respect to various nerd fandoms, operating at a level far below Star Wars or Star Trek, but you might have heard more about it recently with rumors of an Amazon Prime series and Henry Cavill, the former Superman and Witcher himself, being behind the scenes on that one, or just talking about it positively on various talk shows that he's appeared on. Other fans include people like Ed Sheeran, who's been spotted building Warhammer model kits backstage at his concerts. But by and large, despite its popularity, it's managed to stay relatively under the radar compared to some of the other series that are out there with respect to mainstream attention or knowledge. It is what it is. Now, the material isn't necessarily something that's gotten a lot of scrutiny in the past, but that's part of what we're doing here on the Implausipod, especially with the Appendix W series. And the goal of the Appendix W series is to look at some of those sources of inspiration that got folded into the development of Warhammer 40,000. And for those unfamiliar, what is Warhammer 40,000? Well, it's a nightmare gothic future where humanity is fallen, basically. They're still living with high technology that they no longer totally realize how to build and maintain. They are living in the shadows of their ancestors. Humanity spread across the galaxy, across untold millions of planets, united under an emperor in the Imperium of Man, beset by a civil war nearly 10,000 years in the past that tore the empire apart, and now facing foes on all sides with alien races, both ancient and new, vying with humanity for control of the galaxy. Humanity is maintained in this universe by a massive interstellar bureaucracy that redefines the word Byzantine, and much of humanity lives in massive hive worlds where massive cities cover the entire surface of a planet. Ultimately, life for most of humanity in the Warhammer 40,000 is what Hobbes would call poor, nasty, brutish, and short. It's not solitary by any means. There's way too many people around for that to be the case, but still. Now, as we covered earlier in our previous episodes on Appendix W, obviously Games Workshop is a British company, and there is a particular British flavor to a lot of these sources that Warhammer 40,000 drew inspiration from. And we've seen that in some of the sources that we've already looked at, like Space 1999. But even though Frank Herbert is an American author, Dune has had such an impact on the development of sci-fi since its release, it definitely shows up as an impact on Warhammer 40,000. Now, I'm going to lay out the evidence here throughout the rest of this episode. You can take it or leave it as you see fit. But in terms of structure, what I like to lay out here is what we've done in previous episodes looking at Appendix W, and look at it in terms of things like the military examples within the book. Now, not all the sci-fi influences that we list in Appendix W are military ones, of course, but as it's a military war game, that's a big part of it. Then we'll look at other elements of technology, and then cultural elements as well. A lot of Dune's impact on the Warhammer 40,000 universe expands outside of the miniatures war game itself into the larger structure of the setting. So we'll take a brief look at those too, even though that isn't our focus. And then even a work like Dune didn't appear out of nothing, ex nihilo, so we'll look at some of the other sources that were out there that inspired Dune itself. And then I'll wrap up the episode with a brief discussion of the future of Appendix W, so stay tuned. Now looking at a work like Dune, you might think that the main source of inspiration is the planet Arrakis itself, with the hostile environment and the giant worms and everything. That's actually one of the least influential elements. We do see the appearance of various what Warhammer 40,000 calls death worlds, planets that are very hostile to life, that serve as recruiting grounds for various troops within the setting, including various Astromilitarum regiments, including the Talarn Desert Raiders. But the biggest influence from Dune is the existence of the Empire and the Emperor themselves. Within the book, the Emperor is an active participant in the machinations that are taking place in the Empire that they control. Whereas in Warhammer 40,000, the Emperor is a near godlike figure that's barely kept alive by the arcane technology of a golden throne where they've been placed for the last 10,000 years since suffering a near mortal wound in combat. In Warhammer 40,000, the Emperor is not well, but their psychic power serves as a beacon that allows navigation throughout the rest of the galaxy for those who are attuned to it. But despite that difference, the other main takeaway from Dune is the Emperor uses his legions in order to maintain control. Within Dune, the Emperor lends out his personal guard, the Sardaukar, to engage in the combat on behalf of the Harkonnens against the Atreides. Quoting from the glossary included at the back of the original Dune novel, the Sardaukar are, quote, "the soldier fanatics of the Padishah Emperor. They are men from an environmental background of such ferocity that it killed 6 out of 13 persons before the age of 11. Their military training emphasized ruthlessness and a near suicidal disregard for personal safety. They were taught from infancy to use cruelty as a standard weapon, weakening opponents with terror." End quote. Within Warhammer 40,000, when the Emperor was still active, he had, of course, 20 legions of his space marines, the Adeptus Astartes, who were loyal to him. Two of those legions became excommunicado and stricken from the records, and another 9 ended up turning traitor in the civil war known as the Horus Heresy. But the tie is very deep. I mean, both of these draw on some Roman influence, obviously, but still, the linkage directly from Dune to Warhammer 40,000 is strong. And much like the Roman Empire, both of these had the vast bureaucracy that I mentioned earlier. Within Dune, of course, is the various noble houses that the Emperor is playing off against each other, like the Harkonnens and the Atreides, but there's many more besides that. Within Warhammer 40,000 can often be seen within the various governors of various planets or systems who are given a large amount of latitude due to the nature of space travel and sometimes the chance that systems could go without communications for hundreds or thousands of years. And the final major linkage would most likely be the religious one. Within Dune, it's the role that the Bene Gesserit have behind the scenes with their machinations taking place over thousands of years. Within Warhammer 40,000, it's the role of the Ecclesiarchy, the imperial cult that reveres the Emperor as godlike. And as I'm saying this, I realize I'm only talking about the impact of the first Dune novel on Warhammer 40,000 and not the series as a whole. So as we look at later books later on as part of Appendix W, we'll see how some of those other linkages come into play into how Warhammer 40,000 looked at launch and how it's developed subsequently, but for right now we'll just look at the impact that the Bene Gesserit have on the storyline within the novel. Now, despite all these deep linkages that really inform the setting, it's with respect to the military technology that we see the influence that Dune really had on Warhammer 40,000. Despite all the advanced technology in the book, oddly enough, it's a defensive item that comes to the forefront. One of the conceits that we see with Dune is that a lot of the combat takes place with melee weapons, with swords and knives. The reason for that is because of the shields. Reading again from the appendix in the back of the original Dune novel, it describes the defensive shields as, quote, "the protective field produced by a Holtzman generator. This field derives from phase one of the suspensor nullification effect. A shield will permit entry only to objects moving at slow speeds. Depending on setting, the speed ranges from 6 to 9 centimeters per second, and can be shorted out only by a Shire-sized electric field. Bracket, see Lasgun, bracket, end quote. These are the shields that were visible in both movie adaptations early on, with the fight training between Gurney Halleck and Paul Atreides, the ones that made them both look like fighting Roblox characters in David Lynch's 1984 adaptation. Within Warhammer 40,000, we can see evidence of those with the refractor fields that are widely available to various members of the Imperial forces. These are fields that distort the image of the wearer and then bounce any of those incoming attacks into a flash of light. Within the Dune universe, these are so widely available that even common soldiery have them. Though in Warhammer 40,000, they're a little bit more rare, but as we said, it's a fallen empire. The other commonly available tool to the soldiery is that lasgun, which is described again in the appendix as a continuous wave laser projector. Its use as a weapon is limited in a field generator shield culture because of the explosive pyrotechnics, technically subatomic fusion, created when its beam intersects a shield. So even though they're commonly available, they're not widely used because hitting somebody who is wearing a shield with it is like setting off a small nuke. And within Dune, those nukes, or atomics, remain one of the most powerful weapons available to the various houses and factions, to the extent that they're kept under strong guard and rarely, if ever, used. In fact, there's a prescription on their use against human combatants. This is why Paul's use of the nukes against the mountain range during their final assault doesn't provoke sanctions from the other houses. Those sanctions could be as severe as planetary destruction, which in Warhammer 40,000 would be called exterminatus, even though they're not typically framed as being done by nukes. There's a number of other weapons that show up in various ways in Dune that also make their way into the Warhammer 40,000 universe. Everything from the sonic attacks from the weirding modules to the kris knives that are used in ritual combat. And we can see other technological elements as well, like the Fremen still suits, elements of that showing up in the Space Marines power armor in 40K. The look and feel of the mining machines showing up in the massive war machines of the 41st millennium, like the Baneblade or Leviathan or Capital Imperialis, and even the ornithopters themselves, the flapping wing flying machines that show up so prevalently within every adaptation of Dune. All of these will appear at some point within the 41st millennium, even if they're not present within Rogue Trader at launch in 1987. But it's more than just the technology, it's more than just the Emperor and his legions, it's more than just the psychic abilities, which we barely even touched on. There are two essential elements that deeply tie the Warhammer 40,000 universe to Dune. And those two elements are two groups of individuals with very specific sets of skills. The Mentats and the Navigators of the Spacing Guild. Now, the Mentats are basically humans trained as computers to replace the technology that was wiped out in the Butlerian Jihad in the prehistory of the Dune universe. For those just joining us here in this episode, we covered the Butlerian Jihad in depth in the previous episode, in episode 29. It was basically a pogrom against thinking machines that resulted in the destruction of all artificial intelligence, robotics, or even simple computers. Within Warhammer 40,000, the Butlerian Jihad can be seen in the war that took place against the Men of Iron and led to the Dark Age of Technology, again in the prehistory of that universe. And while the Mentats themselves aren't as directly prevalent, because obviously machines still exist, the attitude towards technology, that it's treated as a religious element rather than something that's known and understood, is widely prevalent throughout the universe. The final element is the Spacing Guild. Within the Dune universe, the spice that's only available on Dune, the melange that allows for the navigators to gain prescience and to steer the ships as the Holtzman drives allow them to fold space and move them rapidly through the stars. Over time, through their exposure to the melange, the navigators become something altogether no longer human. Whereas in the 41st millennium, the navigators are outright mutants to begin with, whose psychic abilities allow them to see the light cast by the Emperor on Terra, the Astronomicon that serves as a lighthouse to guide everybody through the shadows of the warp. Now, both of these are mentioned in Rogue Trader in 1987, but they show up much more commonly outside the confines of the miniatures board game, where much of the action takes place. They're prevalent in the fiction and a lot of the lore surrounding the game, even though they rarely function within it, at least within the confines of the Warhammer 40,000 game proper. Now, the Games Workshop has leveraged the IP into a number of different realms, including game systems like Necromunda, Battlefleet Gothic, and their various epic scale war games. So some of those elements are more common in certain other situations. But the linkage between the two, between Dune and 40K, is absolutely clear. Now, as I said at the outset, Dune had a massive influence on not just Warhammer 40,000, but basically sci-fi in general since its release. It spawned five sequels by Frank Herbert himself, which extended the stories, and then Brian Herbert, Frank Herbert's son, and Kevin Anderson have done subsequent stories within the same universe. Galactic Empire has been common throughout science fiction, especially since then, though most notably within the works of George Lucas, the Star Wars series. I believe Lucas has stated at least someplace that Dune was a partial source of inspiration, though some contest that it's a much more than partial and that there's 16 points of similarity between the Dune novels and the original Star Wars film. I think anybody reading the original novel and then watching the film may draw similar conclusions. But influence is a funny thing, and it works both ways, because just as Dune inspired numbers of works, including massive franchises like Star Wars and Warhammer 40,000, Dune was in turn inspired by a number of sci-fi works that were written well in advance of its publication. There's at least five works or series that were published before Dune came out that had elements that appear within the Dune stories. For the record, Dune was published as serials in 63 and 64 and came out as the full novel in 1965. Now, the first link, obviously, is Asimov's Foundation, published as short stories in the 1940s and then as novels in the early 1950s. Here we're dealing with the decay of an already existing galactic empire, and by using math and sociology as a form of prescience, which is the same ability that Paul and the Bene Gesserit have, they're able to predict the future and able to steer the outcome into a more desirable form. Does that sound familiar? Asimov calls this psychohistory, and I'm sure if you're watching the current TV series, you're well aware of that, but wait, there's more. Next up is the Lensman series, written by E. Doc Smith, starting with Triplanetary, which was published in 1948. I mean, there's aliens and stuff in it, but there's a long-range breeding program on certain human bloodlines in order to bring about their latent psychic abilities. And then there's tested with a device called the Lens, which can cause pain to people that aren't psychically attuned to it, which, again, sounds familiar. The third up would be the Instrumentality series by Cordwainer Smith. Now, there's a novel, Norstrelia, which was originally published after Dune came out, but the short stories from the series came out starting in 1955 and through the early 1960s. In it, space travel is only made possible by a drive that can warp space and a guild of mutated humans that are able to see the path between the stars to get humanity to where they need to be. In addition to that, the rulers of Earth are a number of noble houses that are continually feuding amongst themselves and, through various technologies, are extremely long-lived, almost effectively immortal. Now, we've touched on some of that with the Instrumentality before, back in episode 18, and we will be visiting the Instrumentality again, at least twice more, in Appendix W, with a look at Scanners Live in Vain, and then the Instrumentality series as a whole. So if you're interested in more on that, go check out that episode, and stay tuned for more. Now, even the fighting around the giant space harvesters has some precedent. In 1960, Keith Laumer published the first Bolo short story. In it, 300-ton tanks are controlled by sentient AIs, and the story's about how the fighting in and around those tanks go. But of course, we know that there's no AI in the Dune universe because of the butler in Jihad, which Herbert got from Samuel Butler, who wrote it in 1869, and then published it as a novel in 1872, which we talked about last episode and mentioned earlier. So, of course, this influence is almost 90 years before Dune came out. And, of course, the granddaddy of them all was probably Edgar Rice Burroughs' Warlord of Mars. Now, apparently, according to an interview with Brian Herbert, the Dune series was originally proposed to take place on Mars, but it was decided against it because of our cultural associations that we have with the Red Planet. And some of this obviously takes place from the tales that came before it. Now, in addition to the sci-fi influences, there's other real-world influences, like the stories of Lawrence of Arabia, as well as Frank Herbert's own observations that he took in the sand dunes in northern Oregon and the reclamation project that was taking place there to bring back some of the land from the desert. So all of these and more went into the creation of Dune. Now, don't get me wrong. Dune is an amazing creative work, and it draws all these elements and other ones together more than we mentioned. It's unique and interesting, and that's why it's timeless as it is. But everybody draws influences from multiple places. The creativity is in how it gets put together. So we will continue exploring that creativity of both the Dune series and the Warhammer 40,000 series in episodes to come. Once again, thank you for joining us on the Implausipod. I'm your host, Dr. Implausible. You can reach me at drimplausible@implausipod.com, which is also where you can find the show archives and transcripts of all our previous shows. I'm responsible for all elements of the show, including research, writing, mixing, mastering, and music, and the show is licensed under a Creative Commons 4.0 share-alike license. You may notice that there was no advertising during the program, and there's no cost associated with the show, but it does grow through the word of mouth of the community. So if you enjoy the show, please share it with a friend or two and pass it along. If you visit us on implausipod.com, you may notice that there's a Buy Me a Coffee link on each and every episode. This would just go to any hosting costs associated with the show. If you're interested in more information on Appendix W, you can find those on the Appendix W YouTube channel. Just go to YouTube and type in Appendix W, and I'll make sure that those are visible. And if you'd like to follow along with us on the Appendix W reading list, I'll leave a link to the blog post in the show notes. And join us in a month's time as we look at Joe Haldeman's Forever War. And between now and then, I'll try and get the appendixw.com website launched. And for the mainline podcast here on the Implausipod, please join us in a week or so for our next episode, where we have another Warhammer 40,000 tie-in. You see, Warhammer 40,000 is a little lost with respect to technology, and they'll spend a lot of time looking for some elements from the Dark Age of technology. The STCs, or Standard Template Constructs, the plans that they put in their fabricators to chew out the advanced material of the Imperium. You could almost say that these are general purpose technologies, or GPTs. And a different kind of GPT has been in the news a lot in the last year. So we'll investigate this in something we call GPT Squared. I hope you join us for it. I think it'll be fantastic. Until then, take care and have fun.